Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
A new study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Britain's decision to outlaw the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has continued to draw condemnations, with the head of the political bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, saying the resistance movement derives its legitimacy from the Palestinian nation and the free peoples of the world. We now present you an article written by Dr. Firouz Osman, the executive member of the Media Review Network, an advocacy group based in Johannesburg, South Africa. The piece is titled British Government Emerges as Israel's Leading In-House Lobbyist. The British government's discredited Home Secretary Priti Patel has once again emerged as Israel's leading in-house lobbyist. Though her credibility was severely dented when, as the United Kingdom aid minister, she had to resign in 2017 following her scandalous unauthorized meetings with senior Israeli officials, Priti Patel has made a comeback to yet again plunge the British establishment into a deeper foreign policy mess. She has now announced dramatic plans to proscribe Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist entity. Previously, only the military wing of Hamas, the Zadin al-Qassam Brigades, was proscribed under the UK Terrorism Act 2000. In a statement released by her, Patel sounded no different to right-wing hawks in control of the apartheid regime. In her statement, Priti Patel said, Hamas has significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry, as well as terrorist training facilities. That is why today I have acted to proscribe Hamas in its entirety. Though her proscription order was introduced a few days ago and debating and voting were expected to follow shortly, the process will require approval by Britain's Parliament. If approved, showing support for Hamas, including organising events in support of them and flying the movement's flag, could see punishments of up to 14 years imprisonment. Not surprisingly, the Israeli regime has gleefully welcomed Priti Patel's announcement. Israel's Minister of War, Benny Gantz, said, "It sends a strong message of zero tolerance towards terrorist activity aimed at harming the State of Israel and Jewish communities." Absent from most media reports is the bizarre fact that Priti Patel confirmed her moves in a speech on security and counter-terrorism in Washington. BBC diplomatic correspondent James Landale suggested that the decision should also be seen through a domestic UK prism. Landale said, "Israel has been pushing for this for some time, and the fact it is now happening reflects the deep contacts that Israel has within the Conservative Party." No newcomer to controversy, Priti Patel is described by various British sources, including Wikipedia, as Eurosceptic. She was a leading figure in the Vote Leave campaign for Brexit during the 2016 referendum on UK membership of the European Union. Reports indicate that following David Cameron's resignation, Patel supported Theresa May's bid to become Conservative leader. Theresa May subsequently appointed Patel Secretary of State for International Development. However, her breach of the ministerial code in 2017, when Patel was involved in a shameful political scandal involving clandestine meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu and fellow Zionist leaders in the occupied Palestinian territories, ended her tenure as a minister. Though the unauthorized conduct of holding 12 separate meetings during a family holiday to the Palestinian occupied territories without notifying the UK's Foreign Office or No. 10 Downing Street had disgraced her, Boris Johnson ignored Patel's violations by resuscitating her political career. That the controversy surrounding her turbulent political career would expectedly have cautioned responsible leaders, Boris Johnson chose to cave in to the pro-Israel lobby by deploying her in one of the most powerful cabinet positions. In making this outlandish move, Patel has selectively chosen to remain silent on the fact that Hamas have engaged in Palestine's political process and won the legislative elections in 2006, was rebuffed by the British government. In doing so, Britain defied and denied the political choice made by the Palestinian people. As expected, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has expressed its shock and dismay at the move. It called on the British government to apologize for the Balfour Declaration, which illegally set the stage for the creation of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine in 1917, during the month of November. The statement added, "The Palestinian people, backed by the Arab and Muslim nations and the free peoples of the world, will continue their fight for freedom and return at any cost and will not be discouraged by those who fail to support them." The statement added, "We are confident that the Palestinians will fulfill their aspirations for freedom and for independence sooner rather than later." given the fact that Hamas espouses Islamic values and that its defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is profoundly admired, it is widely believed that the overwhelming majority of Muslims across the world support Hamas. Britain's 3 million plus Muslim population would be no exception to this. It goes without saying that solidarity with Palestine's freedom struggle is intertwined with support for the Hamas movement. But by Priti Patel's decree, Muslims and millions of British citizens of various faith groups found to be pro-Hamas will now face criminal charges and the prospect of a long-term jail sentence. Meanwhile, Britain's decision to outlaw the Hamas movement has continued to draw condemnations worldwide, with the head of the Hamas saying the resistance movement derives its legitimacy from the Palestinian people and the free peoples of the world. The head of the political bureau of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, said recently, "These decisions, which are of a political, electoral and biased nature in favor of Israel, will not find any place or influence among the people, the freedom seekers, the elites and the groups that support Palestine." Ismail Haniyeh said, "Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel's decision is a new attack on our people and their rights, and is condemned and deplorable step that depicts Britain's bias towards the Zionist regime." He stressed the move demonstrates the occupying regime's attempts to criminalize the struggle of the Palestinian people. Ismail Haniyeh added, "This will not deter us from continuing to defend our people and their rights by all legitimate means, through comprehensive resistance." In its statement, Hamas also said, "Resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right granted to people under occupation as stated by international law." Furthermore, Lebanese Islamic resistance movement Hezbollah strongly denounced Britain's decision, saying the move is an unfortunate continuation of London's bias in favor of the Israeli regime and its policies that are based on murder, terrorism, massacring of Palestinians and destruction. In a statement on Saturday, 20th of November, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah called on the British government to undo the unjust designation of Hamas as a terrorist organization. According to Lebanon's Al-Manar television network, the statement read, "Hezbollah believes that this decision will not affect the resisting Palestinian people, Hamas resistance movement and its noble fighters and the rest of the resistance factions." The statement added, "On the contrary, Britain's decision will reinforce the determination of the Palestinian resistance to fight the enemy until achieving liberation and victory." Moreover, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has condemned the United Kingdom's decision, stressing the rights of the Palestinian nation cannot be trampled upon through distortion of facts. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said in a post on his official Twitter account on Friday, 19th of November, "We condemn Britain's decision to declare the popular resistance movement of Hamas as a terrorist organization. The rights of the Palestinian people cannot be trampled upon by distortion of facts. The only political solution for Palestine lies in holding a referendum among all indigenous residents." Founded in 1987, Hamas is the largest Palestinian resistance movement. Since 2007, it has ruled the besieged Gaza Strip and has since defended the impoverished enclave against four major Israeli wars, including the most recent 11-day conflict that ended in an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire agreement in May. The Gaza Strip has been under Israeli land, air and sea blockade since June of 2007, when Hamas, which has vowed to resist Israeli occupation, rose to power in the enclave where 2 million people live. The crippling blockade has caused a sharp decline in the standard of living of the Palestinians, as well as unprecedented levels of unemployment and poverty in the territory.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our show aims to address the most important issues in the subcontinent, which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will see how social media giants are censoring human rights abuses in Kashmir. And we will also take a look at how the year-long farmer protest in India has finally paid off.
As the Kashmiris live under a brutal occupation, recurring communications blockade and prolonged aura of fear embroiled by torture, extrajudicial killings and kidnappings, social media giants are turning a blind eye to the human rights abuses faced by the people of the Indian-controlled Kashmir, even now when tensions are high in Kashmir because of the authorities are using innocent civilians as human shields. A report by the Kashmiri human rights organization Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continually silenced Kashmir-related content. What's going on, and why is this happening? Take a look.
In August 2019, India's right-wing BJP government scrapped the autonomous status of Kashmir by revoking Articles 370 and 35A of the Indian Constitution as a part of Modi's campaign to take over the disputed territory. Internet was shut down, curfew was imposed, thousands of Indian troops were sent into the territory, and all opposing voices, including three former chief ministers of the state, were arrested. Even though curfews and internet blackouts were momentarily lifted, they have been regularly reinforced time and again. Up until today, there have been more than 300 instances of internet shutdowns in the disputed territory. But what's interesting is that even when the internet is available, social media conglomerates censor the voices of Kashmir which call for help. According to a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir titled How Social Media Corporations Enable Silence on Kashmir, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have been silencing Kashmir-related content since 2017. According to human rights groups, the human rights abuses in Indian-controlled Kashmir now range from mass killings, enforced disappearances, torture, rape, and sexual abuse to political repression and suppression of freedom of speech, but Kashmiris have no way to tell the world about the atrocities themselves.
It's funny how social media giants like Facebook are on one hand criticized for being too soft on hate speech content, while on the other, they are readily censoring voices which are merely found offensive by the US government. After the US martyred Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in cold blood, Facebook and Instagram accounts of all the uncountable number of journalists, activists, and common people who were posting in support of the slain general were shut down and Facebook accepted that they had to comply with the requests of the US. Facebook did not even shy away from closing down the official account of Press TV, which is followed by 4 million people, simply because the US administration does not agree with it. Where is the freedom of speech, and is that all to do with the double standard policy of this monopoly?
A former Facebook product manager raised the alarm over the not-so-free and safe Facebook. Leaking a trove of internal company documents to the Wall Street Journal, Francis Haugen uncovered the real face of Facebook to the world, and the company tried to hide away from the controversy by hurriedly changing the name of its parent organization from Facebook to Meta. According to the leaked internal company documents, which are also referred to as the Facebook files, Facebook has been aware of hate speech and calls for violence against groups like Muslims and Kashmiris, including posts of photos of piles of dead Kashmiri bodies with glorifying captions on its platform in India, but still, none of their publishers were blocked. The leaks also reveal that for the past 3 years, Facebook has also been conducting internal research of how Instagram affects young users, and Facebook's own findings were that Instagram is harmful to a large portion of young users, where teenage girls were among the most harmed. Researchers within the company reported that we make body issues worse for 1 in 3 teenage girls. Shockingly, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The papers provide revelations regarding topics ranging from toxic Facebook algorithms and dangerous artificial intelligence software to meddling in internal politics of countries and spreading false information.
Now, to have more insights, we are joined by Mrs. Naeemeh Mahjoub, a columnist at Independent Urdu. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mahjoub. Now, a 30-page report by Stand With Kashmir claims that since 2017, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media platforms have continuously silenced Kashmir-related content. Now, do you think this is true?
I think it is, because it has also been confirmed by many international organizations, human rights organizations, as well as the journalist organizations, including Access Now and CPJ and others as well. Human rights organizations has also given report about this. Even in many judicial cases in India, the courts have also admitted it. There are also colleagues of mine in journalist fraternity and other social rights organizations whose social media accounts still remain closed until today, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And you might have also seen that more than 1 million tweets of the account holders were held since 2019. Which had a mere, mention of Kashmir. This has also come in the public domain now. Since 5th of August 2019, when Jammu Kashmir was stripped of its semi-autonomous status, the region had no internet for the last 700 days. And even during the earliest period of COVID pandemic, when the internet was the lifeline of every single person to get information on how to deal with this pandemic, and in Kashmir, and it was total communication blockade. And then the majority of the population in Kashmir and Jammu and Kashmir, the whole region, considers these social media platforms, whether it is Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, they are certainly, complicit with the government in Delhi in disabling the thousands of accounts or restricting the content if there is any mention of Kashmir. Even there was a recent survey by some social activists in Kashmir. They give number of 600 account holders who are prominent journalists, social activists, human rights activists. And they don't have these accounts working now because they're totally closed. And there are artists even, artists, actors, academicians who were raising voice across the globe They are mostly the Kashmiri diaspora. They were raising voice on the appalling situations of human rights in Jammu and Kashmir. Their outreach capacity has been curtailed by these social media platforms. So because of these strict restrictions on local media, and then there's only one narrative of Kashmir's story by Indian mainstream media, it was only the social media which common people have access to or can share their apathy. When you also deprive them of this digital right that's given to 8 billion population of the world, and you can realize the sense of helplessness, hopelessness Kashmiris are going through at this time.
Now, dozens of people from the Sikh community also protested at the Facebook headquarters in California. They also claimed that Facebook and Instagram have been censoring content posted in support of the Indian farmers and about the Sikh community. Now, do you think there's a pattern to this?
Well, you can find this pattern in every part of India now. I mean, where minorities are facing intimidation and harassment every day. There are many reports that accounts and the content got disabled throughout the farmers' agitation in the country, which is now running for the last 1 year. Recently, you might have seen the news, those viral videos also of Tripura, which is in northeast of India. And two social media handlers, including journalists, were slapped with the FIRs for tweeting ground reports on attacks on minorities and their religious places in Tripura. Some were arrested also, and there are many journalists which are still behind bars in Tripura. They haven't got even bail yet. Internet access was shut down there in Assam and Tripura, and still many are denied access to social media platforms. And then you might have also gone the story about this Amravati in Maharashtra, where Mumbai is the commercial capital of India, and there internet was shut down, social media was totally, shut down. There were restrictions all over media, and it's hard to get another shade of the story when you have got only one side of story from the mainstream media, which they get from the government itself.
Mrs. Mahju, I forgot to ask, why is Facebook censoring content in Kashmir in the first place?
I don't have any answer for that, to be honest with you. I think this question needs to be asked to these social media platforms, because why are they taking sides of the government? I mean, maybe it is because of their own commercial interests, or there is a lot of bonhomie, or the influence of the friendly relations of these rulers. But this also negates the claim of the democracies that every citizen has a right to speak or write. This pick and choose policy of the governments as well as of these social media platforms. I mean, you are allowing some people to speak and you are depriving other people not to speak. That puts a huge question mark on the credibility and impartiality of these social media platforms, because they themselves claim that they are the champions of free speech. So social media giants have become, I think, most doubtful in the eyes of the public now. So they need to restore this confidence among the people that they are not taking sides with the government, which people have, I mean, the general impression is that.
Thank you for your precious time and knowledge, Mrs. Mahju. Now, let's see how people reacted on social media on the human rights abuses in Kashmir.
Khalid Baydun wrote, Instagram blocked his story when he tried to talk about crisis in Kashmir. Samir Yasir mentioned that the brutal killing of Shamima was underplayed by newspapers. Zabe tweeted no internet and communication facilities to be allowed in Kashmir, which is total breach with international law and ethics, and still the whole world is silent. What Tyler tweeted, Modi pays a lot and try to silence the media regarding the crisis in Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In 2020, the BJP government led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi passed three controversial farm laws which sparked massive protests in the country. These laws essentially loosened rules that have protected India's farmers from the free market capitalists for decades. After a year of non-stop protests, the hard struggle of farmers has finally paid off. Modi has announced that the laws will be repealed. But what is it that led people to get angry with the laws in the first place?
The three laws being talked about are the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Act, the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement of Price Assurance and Farm Services Act, and the Essential Commodities Amendment Act. These laws, which were introduced in September 2020, were met with widespread angst and widespread disapproval from farmers, who took to the streets to launch a robust protest. The laws were basically meant to deregulate the sector, allowing farmers to sell produce to buyers beyond government-regulated wholesale markets, where growers are assured of a minimum price MSP. This would mean that small farmers would be put up against big businesses, who would then ultimately negotiate prices according to their own holding power. And free market prices would mean that farmers would also lose out on price support for staples such as wheat and rice. The protests, which started off in Punjab, ultimately spread like wildfire. Protesters joined forces together on the streets in a year-long rift with the government, something which is being called the longest agrarian movement in independent India. The protesters were prepared for the long haul right from day one. They set up camp, had trucks full of food and water, and a zealous spirit which kept them united. It is said that after 1 year and more than 700 lives lost during the protests, the protesters have finally won. However, laws are yet to be repealed in the parliament, and let's not decide everything at the drop of a hat.
The farmers from Punjab, who predominantly belong to the Sikh religious minority of India, were the first to grasp the danger when Parliament passed the three controversial bills in a great hurry without a discussion or taking farmers' unions into confidence. The Sikhs since led the farmers' protests in India. Interestingly, Modi made the announcement of backing down from his decision on the occasion of birth anniversary of Sikhism's founder Guru Nanak, whom the Sikhs all around the world follow religiously even after his death.
The Sikh population consists of almost 30 million people around the world, and between 22 million to 28 million live in India. Of those who live in India, around 80% reside in North Indian state of Punjab, which borders with Pakistan. The announcement comes few months before key elections in five provinces of India, one of which is Punjab, where majority of the population are Sikhs. The government BJP party is performing poorly in Punjab, and where earlier farmers had made it almost impossible for BJP leaders to campaign or even hold meetings with their workers in the state. The party is now expected to take credit for undoing a mistake and deciding to bow down before the farmers as it aims to woo the Sikhs, who formed the majority vote bank in Punjab. That's not it, however. The Sikh community have had their own differences with the Indian establishment and right-wing organizations in India. from the Golden Temple massacre in 1984 to the present situation of minority rights, the memory of Sikhs in India is etched with a series of tragedies. Before independence, Sikhs had an empire of their own, and after independence, due to the ill treatment faced by their community, the Sikhs started demanding for a separate homeland of their own, what was called Khalistan Movement. Commentators claim that Modi is afraid that these protests could spark separatist sentiments in Sikhs. Modi's announcement comes right after Sikh community held a referendum in London on the question of whether Indian-governed Punjab should be an independent country. Thousands of people participated, and more referendums are to be held in Canada, EU, and other cities of the UK.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Anwar Rizvi, a South Asia analyst. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Rizvi. Now, could you please tell us why the farmers were unhappy with the farm laws in the first place?
Okay, I'm not going to go too much into the nitty-gritty of the law itself, but I'm just going to give you a general overview of why the Indian government thought that the laws were necessary and why the farmers then rose up against the laws. So basically, India, despite all the technological advances and all the industrial advances that it has made in recent years, it is still a largely agrarian economy. Large parts of the Indian population still rely on agriculture as their main source of income. And particularly in the province of Punjab, which is almost entirely an agricultural state, agriculture in Punjab is not just an occupation, it's actually a way of life, it's part of the culture. And there have been practices that have been in place for decades, for centuries, and they work quite well for the farmers. Most of these farmers are not big farmers. They have small holdings, very small farms which they farm on. A lot of these farmers are not particularly literate. They don't fully understand the markets. They don't fully understand the supply and demand economics. So they rely on the middlemen, who are also, by and large, they're part of the community. Some of them could be village chiefs or other kind of community elders who act as the middlemen between these small farmers, who are the majority of the farming community in the Punjab and also as well as the rest of India. And these middlemen then help the farmers get their produce to the local markets, which are called the mandis, where they are then sold to the wholesalers. And also these middlemen will take care of the farmers by providing them loans when the crops have not been too great and the farmers are in need. And so therefore, these middlemen don't just help these farmers get their produce to the market, they also help them in many other ways. And because they are part of that very community where the farmers themselves come from, therefore, these middlemen are actually a lifeline for these farmers. Now, what the Indian government with this Farming Act wanted to do was to completely replace a tried and tested system, which has been in place for many centuries now, with a more corporate system. So they wanted to bring in big agro-industrial complexes where they would buy directly from the farmers, buy the produce from the farmers, and then distribute that those products across India and obviously to other parts of the world. The farmers were not happy with that because quite simply they thought that something which they have tried and trusted for so long, for generations, is suddenly being replaced overnight with a more corporate system. A lot of these farmers do not understand how the corporate world works. They won't know who to deal with. They won't know the people who are running these big agro-industrial complexes. It would be a totally alien concept for them. And perhaps some reform was necessary, but such a drastic reform in such a short period of time was not something the farmers were willing to accept. Hence, they rose up in protest.
Last but not least, Mr. Rizvi, farm laws are being overturned now. Why couldn't the people pressurize the government in overturning the CAA?
That is a really, really good question, because the CAA, unfortunately, does not impact the overwhelming majority of the Indian population, the Indian citizens. It impacts people who have come from other countries into India. And the law itself is very discriminatory because it blatantly excludes Muslims from applying, Muslims who come in from other neighboring countries into India as refugees or asylum seekers or as workers, and it excludes them from applying for Indian citizenship on the basis they are Muslims.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Rizvi. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media on farmer protests in India.
Claudia Webb MP, a Member of Parliament for Leicester East, has appreciated Indian farmers and believes their protest is an example to the world how injustice must be defeated. Spiritually Speaking believes there are many lessons to take away from the Indian farmers' protest for organizing, for justice, and for individual happiness. Zara Sultana MP wrote a tweet about Indian farmers and mentioned that the will and determination of Indian farmers forced Modi to repeal his anti-farmer laws.
And that was our episode about censorship in Kashmir and farmer laws in India. We hope you enjoyed the episode. We will meet again next week. So till then, take care.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767. Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel has said there was no quick fix to the migrant crisis following the deaths of 27 people in the Channel on Wednesday, 24th of November. Britain's Home Secretary was due to meet with a French counterpart over the weekend but the meeting was dramatically called off on Friday, 26th of November. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Rachel Burford, writing for the London Evening Standard. The piece is titled, Migrant Crisis, Why Do So Many People Head to the United Kingdom? Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel said there was no quick fix to the migrant crisis following the deaths of 27 people in the Channel on Wednesday, 24th of November. The Home Secretary was due to meet with her French counterpart over the weekend, but the meeting was dramatically called off on Friday, 26th of November. France reacted furiously to a public letter released by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, which set out five steps that he thinks both sides should take to tackle the situation, including introducing joint Anglo-French patrols on French beaches and plans to tackle criminal gangs organizing the crossings. Despite millions of pounds spent and dozens of arrests, thousands of people continue to attempt to get to the United Kingdom, with many paying huge sums to do so. Here we look at why so many people are willing to risk their lives to get to Britain and where they are coming from. How many people are crossing the Channel to get to Britain? Small boat crossings began to surge late 2018. More than 24,000 people have made the crossing from France to Britain by boat so far this year, a sharp rise under 8,404 cases in 2020. According to a Press Association report, in 2019, the number of irregular migrants who do not come through traditional legal routes was around 16,000, while it was about 17,000 in 2020. The overall number of asylum applications in the United Kingdom reached 35,737 in 2019. It fell slightly to 29,456 last year as a result of far fewer arrivals by air and an increase in arrivals by small boat across the Channel, according to the British government. Asylum applications peaked in 2002 at 84,132. There is no official record of how many people have died attempting the perilous Channel crossing. Research by the Institute of Race Relations, released in November of last year, found that 292 people had died trying to cross by vehicle, tunnel, or water since 1999. This year, 34 people are believed to have died while crossing the Channel in small boats and dinghies, including the 27 individuals who drowned after their small dinghy sunk on Wednesday, 24th of November, 2021. But which countries are these people coming from? Most migrants heading to Britain come from the Middle East, Africa, or Asia, including Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, Eritrea, Sudan, and Vietnam. But why do migrants leave France or other safe countries to risk coming to the United Kingdom? The British government has long said refugees should seek refuge in the first safe country that they reach. While there is no legal requirement for someone to claim asylum in any particular country, there is a requirement for the first safe country in which they arrive to hear their claim. If this does not happen, then people are free to make claims elsewhere. Charity workers in France have claimed that many people seeking political asylum in France do not have good experiences at the hands of the French authorities. Those with family already settled in the United Kingdom often want to come here, and migrants are also more likely to have some grasp of the English language compared to other European languages. In 2020, Germany received the highest number of political asylum applications, that is 122,015, and it was followed by France in second place with 93,475. In the same period, Britain received the fifth largest number of applicants with 36,041, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Economic divide.
The U.S. is experiencing record inflation standing at a 30-year high. Americans are paying more for cars, for clothes, food, and energy. Now, this is while there are other economies around the world, like China and the U.K., who are also suffering from record inflation. Hi, I'm Kavita Hwai. Stay tuned as we dive into the world of inflation, first in the U.S., then in other parts of the world. We're going to take a look at inflation rate in the U.S., 6.2% in October. It has risen compared to a year ago. That's the fastest annual increase in over 30 years. Americans are suffering as a result of that. Then we're going to take a look at possible reasons for inflation. Higher energy costs, maybe one, an increase of demand due to the post-COVID-19 period. Also, supply chain disruptions like the port crisis. Then we're going to take a look at the spread of inflation, which seems to be a global phenomenon. The impact is being felt around the world. Price increases on basic commodities has occurred. China, UK, and Germany, three countries that are suffering as a result. How bad are other parts of the world?
As the reopening continues, bottlenecks, hiring difficulties, and other constraints could again prove to be greater and longer lasting than anticipated, posing upside risks to inflation.
Inflation that has not been seen in decades. That is the case in the U.S., standing at a 30-year high. This means that Americans are paying more for things like cars, clothes, food, and energy.
Well, when you think about it, we threw $5.4 trillion at the economy. That was about 20 to 25% of GDP. And that's going to be largely reflected in a combination of increased real growth and an increased price level. So yes, the price of goods and services post-COVID will be higher than the price of goods and services pre-COVID.
And here are increases on some everyday products in the U.S. Notice that many of them are in food items.
Definitely regular grocery stores like Giant, Harris Teeter's. Most of the prices for meat and vegetables have gone up.
I think that the particularly like the meats that have been inching up over the last few months. Gas prices today are ridiculous.
Inflation has hit low-income households especially hard because they shell out a larger share of their modest incomes to cover the necessities.
Gas prices are outrageous. They're holding up all these boats in the water, they say, not letting them come in the port. But people are suffering, especially people in middle class and low class, cannot afford to be paying gas prices of $4. Soon it'd be $4.
Some of the factors driving up the prices, higher energy and food prices, strong demand and supply chain disruptions following COVID-19, and a severe shortage of workers, which is driving up wages. Inflation is a serious problem that appears to be plaguing many parts of the world and in different sectors. Our first social media post points to the impact that inflation has had on the U.S. economy, and it's from Edward Snowden. Now, he has said inflation hits 6.2%, wiping out the raises of those lucky enough to even have a good job. Parents who are worried about the price of milk for their kids when the shelves are not empty and the establishment is like this. And we go to another post which said Americans are, by many measures, this from the New York Times, in a better financial position than they have been in many years. They also believe the economy is in terrible shape. Why? Well, let's see if we can get an answer to that question from that post. VJ Varghese joins us. He's from RogueNews.com. He's a contributor to Independent Precious Metals Authority. VJ, welcome. So we just looked at that media post from Snowden saying that parents are worried about giving their kids milk. But then you have this schism where something that the U.S. economy is doing well, yet others don't. Why is there such a contradiction here, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think one of the things that people need to understand is this. In order to understand where inflation is, you got to go back a few years, right? You got to go back to 1971. You got to go back to the 1980s, where we stopped calculating GDP numbers accurately, right? We re-engineered the way gross domestic product is measured. When we did that, we became the first country in the world where we counted government expenditure as part of GDP growth. Okay, so for the longest time, I mean, we've been running ridiculous numbers, and we were able to maintain quote-unquote low inflation through accounting gymnastics, trickery in arithmetic, falsifying data, the day, you know, the list goes on and on.
Okay, that's Vijay there. Interesting how he said gymnastics is being played with the numbers. That was the case for the U.S., but what about the rest of the world? Well, here are some economies whose inflation has hit the news recently. This particular tweet says that the U.S. consumer prices have risen at the fastest pace in three decades. China factory gate inflation has hit 26-year high. Inflation heading to its highest level in 10 years, and your neighbor still thinks that investing in Bitcoin is a bad idea. Well, that person has not taken a look at the Bitcoin numbers recently. Okay, in the UK, this tweet says inflation has hit 4.2%. That is the highest level in a decade and climbing. Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies has said, unless we get pay rises of 7%, the buying power of our earnings is going to be less this year than last year.
Yeah, I mean, this is the highest that inflation's been for almost exactly 10 years. And with the labor market strong, lots of people moving into work, but earnings aren't rising this fast. Of course, we've got some big tax rises coming along in April. And all of this is going to mean, I'm afraid, that unless we're getting, once you take account of the tax rise, unless we're getting pay rises of something like 7%, I'm afraid our the buying power of our earnings is going to be less this year than it was last.
Okay. Let's bring in Sasha Craner. He's the founder of Craner Analytics and a trading advisor to quantitative strategies at CTA, who joins us. All right, Sasha, welcome. So we're looking at major economies around the world who are experiencing inflation, just like the U.S. is. And you're looking at China, for example, whose inflation has risen at 1.5% annual rate last month. Which is double from the 0.7% of the annual rate that it experienced in September. Why is inflation going around the world at the rate that it is? What's going on here?
Well, basically, you know, most of the world today, perhaps the whole world today, has adopted this same monetary system, which today is purely based on fiat currency and essentially unrestricted possibility for monetary authorities to engage in monetary expansion. So basically, you have an uncontrolled rise in debt, which in the Western world has now exceeded about 300% debt to GDP. The debt has become unpayable. In the West, an estimated 20% of all corporations are now zombies, which means that they cannot even service their the interest